Hey, this is Kevin Weatherby of Save the Cowboy. I want you to toe that stirrup, throw a leg over the cantle, take a deep seat, and pull your hat down tight. I ain't gonna tolerate no whining or griping, so let's all strike a long trot down that narrow trail and learn how to ride with God. Come on! What you waiting on? Let's go.
All right, we're live. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Save the Cowboy. If this is your first time, I just want to welcome you in and let you know that I am not Kevin Weatherby. This week, Kevin is practicing what the Kansas City Chiefs have coined as load management. So he's taken the week off and has entrusted me to preach on a chapter of Job, which I'm very excited about. Before we start, let's go to God in prayer real quick. Lord, we just thank you for this wonderful opportunity that we live in a place where we can just gather and come to you as a community and talk about our problems and our struggles and all of that, Lord. And more than anything, we're thankful that you're so sovereign and an authority in our lives that you provide us the opportunity to struggle, to learn from our mistakes and to just grow in you, Lord. It's such an underrated quality. I pray today that you just speak the correct words for me, that there's people that need to hear what needs to be said today, Lord, and that you just deliver it in an unmatched way, like you always do, Lord. Thank you so much for just all the love and grace and the wonderful qualities that we get as Christians, that we get to follow you and learn from you and just become better disciples, Lord, because of the examples like Job and others in the Bible that you have given us. It's in your name we pray, amen. So I actually had a really good prep week in preparation for this sermon. We talked a little bit up here. We've been in this sermon series on the book of Job, right? And this is going to be the third installment of a fourth series. And when Kevin and I sat and talked about this, I was a little iffy, right? Like I'm fairly new to preaching. We did the Sunday evening service thing for a year. And never once have I ever touched on the book of Job. So when Kevin and I talked about this series, and we sit and talk about most of the content that he wants to do, he tries to get everybody's opinion, whether this is a good idea, get a good pulse on it, whatever. And he let me know that he was going to take a week off and ask if I was interested in preaching this series. That's kind of your first reaction, right? The book of Job, like he said, is like trying to ride an unstarted colt. It's just wild, especially if you're a new Christian. So I'm really, really excited. But in preparation for today's sermon, since it happened, as a teenager, I don't know, I was probably 13 or 14, I went to live with another family that wasn't the family I grew up in. And it was actually a real blessing for me. It was a period in my life where I was struggling. Things weren't going well at school. Things weren't going well at home. So there was these family friends that were in our life who invited me to come live with them. And what I was really excited about was I was going to get to go to a high school that had a better football team, right? So I was going to get to play football. And it ended up being a really good thing because it provided some structure in my life. I'd, to that point, never really had like accountability. I got to do whatever I want. Didn't have a lot of those great things. And this family provided that. In preparation for this, I was thinking one night about a crazy story that happened when they first invited me into their house. So to set the picture, right, I'm living with these family friends. They have a son my age. We were probably in the eighth grade, maybe 14 at the oldest. And they had a son my age, which is why I knew them and our family knew them. And then they had two younger kids, probably a daughter that was about five, maybe six, or a son that was about five, maybe six, and a daughter who was like eight or nine at the time. So the parents of the household tell us like, hey, we're going out tonight with some friends. We need you guys to babysit the kids. Not exactly what a teenager wants to be doing on a Friday night, but again, all the great things that they provided, sure, we'll oblige to that. So we're babysitting their kids, which was just a terrible idea. Like we were not even ready for that. You couldn't have asked me to babysit a goldfish at that time. So we're babysitting their kids, and we're sitting there watching a show on MTV. And I'm not going to say the name of the show on MTV, but most of, at least probably the guys in here are going to know what it is. It's this show where these gentlemen, if you want to call them that, do really goofy things that like hurt themselves or just funny things to get laughs out of people, right? And they got really, really rich doing that. So as I always say now, like idle hands are the devil's playground. If you don't have a lot going on, usually, especially a 14-year-old boy is going to resort to doing something stupid. So I came up with this wonderful idea. there was a kettle sitting at the top of the stairs, and I said, you know what? I turned to my friend and said, dude, I just had the best idea. Now, those of you that are parents know that any statement by a 14-year-old boy that starts with, dude, I just had the best idea, is not a good idea, right? I said, what if you pack me into that kennel and you push me down the stairs? But here's the kicker. Record it on your phone and we'll put it on YouTube, right? So at that time, YouTube was brand new and we were seeing stories of like guys playing video games and making $20 million a year. And so I'm like, dude, we can make a viral video and we're at least gonna make $100 off of this idea. So he looks at me, he's like, man, I don't know if that's a really good idea. Like, you could get hurt and there's this wall at the bottom of the stairs. And I'm like, stop, say no more. I've calculated all of this. What we'll do is we'll pack me into this kennel. And we'll put all the pillows from the couches in there to fill the void space in here. Like NASCAR does it, it'll keep me nice and safe and nothing bad ever happens with that, right? So I'll be padded in here, dude. And then if there's anything left over, we'll put the stairs or the pillows in front of the wall at the bottom of stairs. Those will stop me. We're good. He looks at me and is like, well, I didn't think about that since you calculated it. I trust you, buddy. Let's do this. And it's funny, I love to look at God's creation and look at like the wisdom of a 14-year-old teenage boy compared to an 8-year-old teenage or 8-year-old girl. Because she had way more common sense than the rest of us, right? Right away, she's like, you guys should not do that. That is a very bad idea. And we're like, yeah, what could possibly go wrong? So I get into this kennel. He packs all the pillows in. I'm sitting there like this, looking up at him, because for some reason I decided to get in as the kennel was laying down. He gives me the quick thumbs up. He's like, you ready to go, buddy? All good? I'm like, hey, are the pillows in front of the wall and the stairs? He's like, yeah, we're good. Yeah, let's do this. So we start, and one of the miscalculations I made in my calculations, right, is I didn't calculate that. At that time, I was probably 140, 150 pounds, and my buddy was like 95 pounds soaking wet. So I planned on him pushing me down the stairs and we just guide, we make this perfect video. But what actually happened is when he went to push me, he had to use a little leg power, right? So he lifted, the lip caught on the stairs, and all of a sudden I'm tumbling down the stairs. Now I'm under the belief that when you tumble, when you front flip, forward is better than backwards, right? So at least I was going forward. Like back here, you need your brain stem to regulate your breathing and all that. Up here, my head is pretty thick, so a concussion's not gonna hurt me at all. So I'm tumbling forward, and I don't remember much about being in there, but what I do remember is the sound of me going down the stairs, every single thud, and these were massive stairs. There was like 20 or 25 of them. So every thud, it's like boom, 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 and it sounds like somebody pushed like a washing machine full of bowling balls down the stairs. And then the beautiful thing about gravity is all of a sudden, I just stopped. Vertically though, just like I was loaded. So I'm sitting there looking up like this, a little bit concussed, not knowing what's going on. And my buddy comes and is excited and opens the door. And he's like, dude, get out. Pulls all the pillows out. And me and his 5-year-old little brother just start celebrating. We're like, dude, that is awesome. That is the coolest thing that just ever happened. Like, it's like one of those celebration scenes where everybody's dancing and crying and there's inspirational music happening in the background, just like the dumbest scene you've ever seen. And then all of a sudden, the little girl with wisdom, right, comes running around with her hands on her head and says, oh my gosh, there's a hole in the wall about this big. I was like, that was weird. So our jubilee at that point goes to automatic dread. And we run around and I kid you not, like, I know this is going to be surprising to you guys, but there's a hole about this big, the size of a kennel, in a piece of drywall that was there separating a room and a bathroom at the bottom of the stairs. Who would have thought? So we did out what boys do, right? Like, all right, parents are going to be home in 45 minutes. We got to figure out a way to fix this. Like, you got paint in there? And I know nothing about drywall. Like, there's no way we're fixing this. I'm like, dude, he brings out some Elmer's glue, and I'm like... My second idea, I'm like, okay, maybe the glue will work. Move a little piece of drywall here and see if you can like stuff some of those pillows back there and maybe we'll glue it, throw some paint over it, and we'll be fine. Nothing worked, right? So we resorted to like what we see Adam do in the book of Genesis. When everything's wrong and you have that shame, I'm just going to run and hide, right? And the things that are going through my mind at this point, like, I was put in a really, really good situation. This family let me into their household. They did so much for me, things that I didn't deserve, and now I've just done this to them. So we're hiding in shame. The parents get home. Interestingly enough, the dad walks right by the wall and says nothing. Goes right to bed. We're like, all right, we might be able to get away with this. So then mom comes in. She's standing right in front of this hole in the wall and calls us to the bottom of the stairs to talk to us. And the whole time she's talking to us, and it becomes, it's like watching one of those movies where the murderer is right behind you. Like, was right behind you, and we're just, hey guys, how was your night? How was dinner? And we're just like, good. Looking at this big hole in the wall. And finally the suspense was killing me and I couldn't do it anymore. And I'm like, all right, I need to tell you something. There's a hole in the wall behind you and I did that. So she turns around and looks at it. And then you can imagine the emotions at that point, like really angry. Honestly amazed at the amount of stupidity that it took. And now that I'm older, I understand that. I bear with you parents on that one. But that honestly taught me a lesson that I have never forgotten in my life. And it seems like such a simple story, but somebody with so much authority, so much ability to love and punish and all of these things that they were free to do, they chose to show me grace at that point. I'm thinking that I'm kicked out of this house. I have to go back to my old life. I was doing so well. And instead of that, they showed me a little grace. They didn't bail me out. Like, the consequences of what I did was, well, one, you're going to have to fix that. You're going to have to work all summer to find the money. I didn't have a job or anything at that point. There was punishment behind it, right? Her authority was seen, but I'll never forget, and it's taught me this lesson the rest of my life as a Christian, as a leader, as all of those things, that when you have the power to exercise authority, that's a huge responsibility. But the best and kindest way to do that, the way you will win people over, is by also showing a certain amount of grace. Like I said earlier, today we're going to be in the third part of a four-part series on the book of Job. And what have we learned at this point? Number one, let me ask everybody, raise your hand if you did your homework. If you remember, both we're in week three, right? Week one and week two, you guys had homework. And it came in the form of a question, right? Week one, we did Job chapter 1 and 2. And we said that was what we call a prologue. So like in a movie, the prologue is where you start to get information, right? It's the introduction to the movie. So we see that Job is introduced, and at some point in the story, Satan is roaming around the earth, comes to speak to God, talks to God about, God essentially brags to Satan about Job. And then it starts the discourse where Job tells Jesus that, Satan tells Jesus, God, that Job only worships him because you have given him everything. Job is a wealthy man, but it says he's also a good man, right? He faithfully serves, he's humble, he's all of these things that we would call a good person, right? And then God says the infamous words, the way Kevin put it, and my crowd here will understand this. I'm going to lean on them a lot. He says, bet, right? So we see that in chapters 1 and 2, and then all of these bad things start happening to Job at the permission of God. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And then what we move on, week 2, chapters 3 through 37 is what we call dialogue, right? So we start to see Job start suffering, is having a really bad time because of these things that are happening to him. And we start to see kind of the discourse between him and the people in his life, right? It talks about a sorely wife. People pushing him to move away from God and curse his name and all of those things. And then we left off right at the end of verse 37 last week. What was happening? Well, Job had been having the conversation with his friends, and in my humble opinion, the discourse between him and his friends was fair, right? They start talking about theology, and they get on the idea that, well, if this is happening to you, Job, then you must have done something to deserve this, right? And I think that's fairly relatable. Like, the theology of that is a tad bit off, but I think we've all been there in our life, right? We've talked about it ad nauseum up here, like, do good, receive good, do bad, receive bad. But what we find in the Bible and what we're going to find today is that that's not how God operates at all. So he's talking with his friends, and that's where it kind of left off, right? The do good, receive good, do bad, receive bad thing. So where we're going to pick up in verse 38 this week, and I'm really, really, really excited about this, is this is where God interjects. So God is actually going to speak on, you know, in the book of Job and speak to what is happening and why. And what I love about this is that God is going to do it in the form of asking questions, right? And the overarching theme that I want people to understand today goes back to our two homework questions. The first one we asked in the first week was why would a loving God allow suffering, right? And we really asked two questions. Why do we suffer, and why would a loving God allow us to suffer? And is there any benefit to that? And then the last week we asked, I think, a more important question, and that was, does God have enough authority in your life to tell a story through you in any way that he sees fit? So I want to take that question and take it further today, and I want us to ask ourselves, not only does God have enough authority, but I want to change authority to one other word. Is God sovereign enough in your guys' life to allow him to tell his story through you in any way that we please? Because I think at the very least, I think a lot of us hold frustration for God, if you're anything like me, in these moments of suffering, because our perception of God's protection on our life when we give our life to Christ and become Christians is at least a tad bit skewed. And what I mean by that is we have an unfair expectation that we are not going to suffer as Christians when we give our life to Christ, right? That it's going to be this prosperity gospel where nothing bad ever happens to us, and if we do good, we get good, right? But that's not what we see. And I think, especially as a leader, as a person who manages people, those kind of expectations can be so detrimental to our relationships and our communication. The expectation, like I have people mad at me all the time because they were doing things that I never asked of them. And some of that falls on me, right? Like there's a communication problem. But what I want us to look at is in Job's suffering and everything that he goes through, where does God's sovereignty lie in this? So if you have your Bibles open to Job chapter 38 is where we're going to be at. Job 38. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? There's not going to be a lot of Bible reading in here. A lot of this is going to be recap because I have to find a way to fit five chapters into like 45 or 50 minutes. But God asks an important question here. And every question he's asking has an answer. Right? So he asks, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Does God have the right to tell his story through you? Is God sovereign enough in his life to tell his story through you? What I love about each one of these chapters, and I'll go back to that as I digress from my other point, is that each chapter, 38, 39, and then I'll group 40 and 41 in together, each chapter, God is asking a question that points to a certain quality about him. So God repetitively asks Job questions like this through this chapter, and what he is asking speaks to what I just said. Do you believe that I am sovereign in your life? And he gives specific examples. Like, hey, I was sovereign enough to create the earth, and I'm sovereign enough to know how many hairs are on your head. What he is saying is what I like to call the 30,000 foot view perspective. I'm under the firm belief, and only because I've experienced this in my life, that a lot of our problems stem from the fact that our perspective is just a tad bit off. Like the most talented, well-tuned, great attitude people I know are that way, not because that they don't face adversity, but because their perspective of things is just incredible. And I think that's the ultimate lesson that Job is trying to, that we're trying to learn here in Job. But I call it the 30,000 view perspective. We are such emotional people, and we're so in the moment type of people that we tend to fail to see the big picture. Like the big picture for us is an 8x10 snapshot of what exactly is happening in our lives at that moment. And we have to remember, and I think this is where the disconnect is, you know, whether it be with your spouse or your boss or God himself, that God paints on a canvas the size of the universe. Like he has that 30,000 foot view. And when you have that view, you see things that you don't understand. What I always tell my employees or people that I talk to about this, we do a thing in the fire department called a size up on every call. So, and I teach my employees, like it is my job when we show up to a fire for me to look at the building, figure out the layout of the building, and then make a tactical decision on how we're going to tackle this emergency based off of the conditions I'm seeing in the building, my knowledge of the building. We call that a size up. And I try to teach my employees to do their own size up. Like, hey, I want you to make educated decisions based on the evidence that is being presented to you. And what I always tell them, and they give me crap all the time because I'm always saying stupid sayings all the time. But the Mona Lisa would look awfully ugly if you're so close to it that you're only staring at the bottom right corner. Think about that, right? If we're so in tune to our suffering or what's presently going on in our lives and emotionally reacting to that, we're missing the bigger picture here. And that's what we see God saying to Job at this point, is really, to put it in terms that we would understand, do you understand what I understand? And the answer is no. Do you understand what I understand? God is speaking in this chapter to his sovereignty, which I think is sometimes a tough thing to hear. Raise your hand if you like to be told what to do, right? And that's what God is saying, is like, hey, you may not agree with my decisions, but you don't understand what I understand about you, and you don't understand the depth of my love and what I have inside for you. So I need you to trust me a little bit. And that, my friends, is the definition of sovereignty, right? The dictionary definition of sovereignty is to have complete and utter authority. If I tell things to, or if I want things to happen a certain way, I say it and that's done. And that can be tough for us, right? Because especially us millennials or lower, we have to be told how to do everything, right? And I'm not gonna do anything unless you tell me why I'm doing it. But God has given us a different view here. Like, we have to understand that there's an amount of faith that is built into this. And the reason God asks us to be faithful is because we don't have the 30,000 foot view. We don't understand or have to deal with what he has to deal with. He has the plan for our lives, and all that he asks is for us to be faithful. That, my friends, is the definition of sovereignty. And that's what we see in this, is God is asking us to acknowledge that he is more powerful than we are and give him control. And here's the beautiful thing about God's sovereignty, and it relates directly back to the story that I was telling this morning, is more often than not, when God is exercising his sovereignty, he chooses to exercise grace and love more than he does authority and power. And I want you guys to think about how deep that is for a second. In times when we are undeserving, which we all are, right? In times where we have messed up and have just fallen short of the glory of God, he still loves us and he's still there with us and he's willing to shape us and teach us a lesson and get us to go where he wants us to go. That is beautiful, my friends. So moving on, right? In 38, God speaks entirely to his sovereignty on Job. And they're listening, right? What God is essentially saying, I know we said in verse 1, Kevin whipped out a term that probably only these guys understand, where he said, bet, right? He's saying, go ahead, devil. It's not going to happen the way you think it's happening. But what God is saying in verse 38 is another term that I learned from TikTok about 2 weeks ago. God is saying, I am him. Do you guys know what that means? It's capital H, capital I, capital M. That means I am running things around here and I know what I am doing. Like, I am confident in myself. I am him. That is what God is saying in verse 38. So let's move on then. So God is telling us that he is sovereign, but what's he say? Going on to 39? God goes on to describe the wonders of his creations, the sea, the rain, like all of these great things. That Job, by the way, Job is us. Anytime we see the name Job in the Bible, the illustration is for us. But he's talking about all these great, wonderful things, the mountains, the dew on the grass, like all of these things that were his design. To design something takes a little bit of wisdom. Anybody disagree with that? What God is talking about, especially in verse 39, and it's about 50 verses of God asking the same question to point to the fact that God has wisdom that we can't comprehend, right? If we have a sovereign God, that also implies that there's a little bit of wisdom with God. And that's what God is talking about here. And that's important because I talked about perspective earlier, right? Perspective is important, but perspective means nothing if we don't have the wisdom to shape it. If we're left to our own devices, to our own understanding, we're not going to understand what's going on. We're not going to have this wisdom. So when we see the suffering of Job, and it's really, really, really hard to answer that question as a pastor and whatever you want to call it. What I see is God allowing somebody to gain some wisdom. Maybe in an unconventional way to us that we don't understand, but how blessed are we that we get to learn a lesson from the creator of the universe?
answers.
And every single question that God asks in 39, and it's question after question after question after question, is pointing to the fact that I know things that you do not know or that you can't comprehend. That's what he's telling Job right there. We'll put it this way, and I was lucky to sit with Ty and Kevin this week, and we kind of talked a little bit about our sermon, but really about life in general. Like, we do that a lot, and it's a really good opportunity for me to gain wisdom from guys who are, one, have way more life experience than me, but guys who are probably smarter than to get into a kennel and roll down the stairs. So, Ty's like, I have some stories to tell you. Kathy's shaking her head like, but I was lucky. We sat and talked this week, and we talked about a little bit of wisdom, and they said something that really stuck with me. And it's this, because we talked about the book of Job. We talked about suffering. I asked the question, like, how do I take what I know about Job's suffering and say it to all of these people? And I love what they said here. Suffering is a crown to wear, not a crutch to bear. Think about that for a second. Your suffering is teaching you a lesson. God is shaping you for something. And when we look at our suffering from an 8x10 snapshot, right, of course, it's going to be an emotional response to that, and we don't like it. But then I read through the Bible, and I look at, like, let's take Paul for an example. Paul was one of the most chipper, most of the time. He could get kind of angry if you didn't run the church right, but Paul wrote the book of Philippians. Philippians theologically is known as the book of joy. Do you know the conditions he was in when he wrote that book? He was captive. He was starving. He was being beaten, being prepared to be beheaded and die. And in those conditions, Paul wrote the book of joy. What about Peter, right? Did Peter suffer at all? Absolutely. After Christ died, Peter's life just, by all intents and purposes, went downhill. And he was, he became the leader of the church, but I don't think that was a great thing at that time, because they were facing persecution and all of those things. And he ended up dying a very not pleasant death. And then we look at other disciples like John, same thing. Described as the disciple that Jesus loved. All of these guys provided some blueprint for us that God honors suffering in our lives. And they were happy to do it. So I look at those stories and I ask myself, if those guys can do it, what am I missing? If those guys could follow Christ, do what he says, submit to his sovereignty, realize that there's wisdom that they don't understand, and be peaceful beings even though these nasty, nasty things are going to happen to them, what are we, and more specifically, I missing? In my inability to take control of my suffering, I forget that it is an honor to suffer for God. I didn't make the rules. I'm not pulling this out of nowhere. Like, it says that in the Bible. And we're showing that time and time and time again. And it goes back to that expectation thing I talked to, right? Like, our expectations are at least a tad bit skewed of God's protection from suffering in our lives. So if we're going into this with the idea that, I'm more guilty of this than anybody else. If we're going into this with the idea that now that I'm a Christian, bad things are never going to happen to me. And if they do, it's God's fault. We at the very least have a very unbiblical understanding of God's protection on our life. And I think that if I never suffered, if I never went through trials or tribulations or any of that stuff, I would never quite understand the full extent of God's love and wisdom on my life. And I would never grow into the man that God wants me to be. So we see that over and over and over again. And the other thing I like to think about is, not only does God honor suffering in our lives, but we as a society absolutely honor suffering, with a caveat, as long as we're not the ones suffering, right? Think about it for a second. We watch the movie Superman, and he goes to save a woman on the tracks, gets ran over by a train, and dies. We honor that, don't we, right? We call that a hero, or a soldier that comes over from overseas and was able to save a bunch of people but lost his leg in the process. We honor that. So we as a society honor it. God honors it, but for some reason, I don't like it, right? It doesn't sit well with me. That's where God's sovereignty and wisdom comes in. It's the sign of a real spiritually mature person. Ty has me real self-conscious because I talk with my hands all the time. I'm a tad bit Italian, believe it or not, so I like to talk with my hands, but we start to see that benefit on our life. So moving on, right? 38, God's sovereignty. 39, God's wisdom. 40 and 41, I'm going to group together, and this is what's being said here. If you can with me, turn to chapter 41, verse 1. And God says this, and I know people are going to love this in this building because I hear it all the time. Can you catch a Leviathan with a hook? Pause there. I just want the record to show that I have talked about giants and Leviathan now because people complain about it. Can you catch a Leviathan with a hook or put a noose around its jaw? Can you tie it with a rope through the nose or pierce its jaw with a spike? Will it beg you for mercy? I absolutely love that. If you want a picture of God's power right there or his sovereignty, even the giants that we are so scared of fall on their knees and beg him for mercy. Or implore you for pity. Will it agree with you or work with you to be your slave for life? So in chapter 40 and 41, God talks about all these majestic things that really point to God's majesty. Giants that he has power over, mountains, like all of these mighty things that God has created with his own hands at the snap of a finger. He's not saying this as what my friends here would coin a flex, right? He's not trying to brag. What he's trying to do is to get Job, and by the way, we're all Job, right? To understand the vastness of his power, of his sovereignty, and of his wisdom. Of all the qualities of God, I think we neglect to recognize God's majesty more than anything else. I want you to picture this for a second. You're riding your horse. It's a beautiful June morning. The sun is coming up and you see the most wonderful sunset. Like, what goes through your brain at that point? If you're anything like me, I struggle so much with being in the moment and trying to get my to-dos checked off and all of these, the busyness of life, that I fail to sit there and just rejoice that we have such a majestic God that gives us that beautiful view. And that's really, really important. And I want to give you guys some extra credit homework that if you haven't taken a moment to stop and look over there at that view that we drive every day and I don't even notice sometimes, and thank God that he is so majestic, and remind yourself that God loves you and you serve that God, do it. Like, more than anything, here in Colorado, we see God's majesty all the time. And really, where we see God's majesty and what's being said in here is that we see God's majesty in his creation, right? In God's creation, we see his majesty. And I think about that and I think, okay, God's creation, I see his majesty. And it says in the Bible that I'm God's ultimate creation. So then it bears the question, if we are God's ultimate creation and we see God's majesty through his creation, do people see God through me? It's an important question. Do people see God in everything that you do? Do your children see a godly mother or a godly father? Do your coworkers see somebody so full of grace and so giving and just everything that exemplifies Jesus and Christianity? Like, if we are God's ultimate creation, then it's our ultimate responsibility for people to see God's majesty through us. Big deal. So that's a real quick recap of what's going on in these chapters. In closing, I want to close with a quick story, right? But let me recap real quick. God comes in and really what's affectionately I'm going to coin a complain fest, right? Misery loves company, and Job and all his friends are getting together, and just the worst is coming out of those conversations, right? Things that are theologically inaccurate, bad advice, like misery truly does love company. People are absolutely products of their environment. And in God's timing and his wisdom, he starts to speak to them. And in 38, he's asking questions that he knows answers to, like you guys would to your children, right? If I ask you a question, most of the time I know the answer, and that's what God is telling him. And in 38, he's telling him, I need you to trust, and I need you to have enough faith in me to realize that what I'm telling you is powerful enough to deliver you as a person. And in 39, he's talking about, I need you to trust and understand that what I'm telling you is coming from wisdom because I know everything. I'm a sovereign and authority in all things in your life. And 40 and 41, he's saying, not only am I the boss of your life and I'm the brains of your life, but I want to be the little bit of emotion in your life as well, right? Like, I want you to lean on me and see that everything in this world has purpose and you're my ultimate purpose. I think about God's sovereignty this way, and I've actually told this story on one of the sermons on Sunday night. But there's a really, really popular fire that happened in actually Worcester, Massachusetts in 1999. And we study it all the time. One of the best things about being a firefighter is I'm a history buff and I love to learn from history. So we do that all the time. Like, we look at tragic situations where people lost their lives and try to learn and get better from them, right? Kind of speaks to the point of suffering. But there was a fire in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1999 where six firefighters ended up dying. And what happened was, and I promise this isn't all doom and gloom, there's a point. What happened was a fire started in an old abandoned meat warehouse. So in this warehouse, it's an old brick building. There was a homeless couple sleeping in there, and they knocked over a candle. The challenging thing about the construction of this building was it was just full of old meat lockers that doors would close behind you, and it's just a disaster to be in if you can't see. So they knock this candle over, they run and leave. The fire department is dispatched there because they people smell smoke. They show up and don't see anything. Kind of the characteristic of this building was not only was it brick, but it because it was a cold storage warehouse, it had cork insulated walls that were 18 inches thick. So you weren't going to see anything from the outside of that building. It is very well insulated, which means it keeps heat in. So they send a crew of firefighters up there to investigate to see what's going on. And the odd thing about this is they show up and the business owner says, hey, you guys have to go in there. There's a homeless couple that lives in there. And if there's anything going on in there, you have to go save those people. So they go up there to do that, and they find that there's really, really bad fire conditions up there. They end up getting trapped in one of those meat lockers, right? So they call a mayday, and what happens when a mayday goes out? We send another crew to get them, right? Those are our brothers. Those are our family. Like, they're not going to die in there. We're going to go in there and get them and pull them out. That crew goes up there. They get trapped. So what do? They call a mayday. I'm going to send another crew to go get those guys. So one of the teams that was actually inside fighting the fire split from doing that and said, hey, we kind of have an idea where they're at. We're going to go get them. That team gets trapped. So guys outside are getting anxious, like, hey, six of my brothers are in there struggling and not going to make it very long if I don't do something. So guys are fighting to get in there. And I'll never forget, like, I watched this on a documentary, the incident commander, the guy that sits in the SUV and does nothing. There's like three firefighters that laughed at that in here. The guy who sits in there and tells us what to do on the radio finally got out and said, hey, no more. I'm stopping the bleeding right here where this is at. And if you've never made a decision for somebody else's life, you'll never understand how tough of a decision that was. They said that guys were spitting on him, guys were swinging on him and had to be held back, and he was standing in front of the door and said, hey, it kills me what happened to those guys, but I can't let that happen anymore to any one of you guys. And the odd thing about that was that guys who got to go home the next morning, who got to live to see their sons graduate high school and walk their daughters down the aisle, hate that man for making that decision for them. And I think about that story, and I think it applies perfectly to the story of Job. Like, this is a not very fun, terrible, tragic thing that happened to somebody, right? But through it, all of us have a lesson to learn. All of us have a blueprint. If you know me, if you've heard me preach before, you know I love to use the word blueprint because they're all over the Bible. That there is something to your suffering, that there is a lesson to be learned. And I love learning lessons. I love sovereignty. I'm an expert on sovereignty, right? I know everything about sovereignty except how to spell it. It's a joke. But there's a lesson to be learned here, right? And I think what the overall lesson in the book of Job is, and especially the chapters that we just covered, is not that you're not going to suffer, or not that bad things aren't going to happen to you, or not that God allows bad things to happen to you because you're a bad person. But if you're willing to go through this and grow in character and learn, there's peace on the other side of your suffering. That's what we see with Paul and John and Peter and all of those people that I talked about. They didn't unlock a blueprint that stopped them from suffering. They unlocked a blueprint that said, you know what? I'm here temporarily on this earth to glorify God. And he's allowed to do that through me in any way that he pleases. And I think really, really, really that our biggest cheat code, the biggest comfort that we have as Christians is that no matter what happens to us, our promise isn't here, it's there, right? God prepares a house for us. If we're just willing to do what he asks and trust him and gain wisdom and learn and be gleefully obeying Christians, there's a peace that's offered through that. Anybody ever know like a Christian who was dying of an illness or anything like that? And you ever realize how much peace those people have found, right? It's the same theory. The only difference between them and me, Tyler Lowe, is that I emotionally react to those things, right? I take my circumstances and I blame God instead of figuring out what God is trying to tell me most times. But there is peace to what we do. And I love that more than anything in the book of Job. There's two things I love. One, the peace that you see time and time and time again that everybody finds in the Bible who's obedient to God. Doesn't mean bad things aren't going to happen. They're certainly going to happen to you. But your perspective leads you to peace. And then the other thing I love, and it's actually in chapters 1 and 2, and I told Kevin this was my favorite thing about the book of Job, that God is so sovereign that even the devil has to ask him for permission to do anything in your life. Think about it. I'm really guilty sometimes of thinking about God and Satan as even foes, like they're on the same level playing field. But if you read chapters 1 or chapters 2, every time that the devil wanted to do something to Job, he had to ask God for permission first. That's the sovereignty and the power and all of those great things that God holds in your life. Do our homework this week, right? Think about those questions. Why would a loving God allow bad things to happen to people? And I hope that question's starting to be answered for you guys. And our new question, right? Is God sovereign enough in your lives, in my life, that I trust him to tell a story through me that I have no control over? Let's go to God in prayer. Lord, I just thank you that that you do know everything, Lord, that you guide me, and all that you ask is that me and everybody here is faithful to what you ask us to do, Lord. That you give us the strength to do that if we're willing, because it's so hard. It's so hard to let go of control of things, and it's so tough to be vulnerable and to realize that we don't have the answer to everything, Lord, but you show up in a big way in our lives, and you guide us, and I know personally, Lord, that you protect me from my own stupidity, and you guide me with your wisdom, not my own understanding. And it's just so wonderful, Lord, that you're willing to do that. As we go on, Lord, I pray that everybody in here, myself included, feels your majesty in everything that we do this week, that others see that through us, that we're willing to worship you, Lord, because you have the power to crush us, to destroy us, but you instead don't hold it against us, Lord, and you love us and you show us grace and mercy, Lord, and may we in turn just show that to everybody else. May people see your majesty, your grace, your love in everything that I do, Lord, and may that go to everybody in this room, that we'll serve you faithfully and we'll love you and we'll love others because that's what you've asked us to do, Lord. And we know that we're going to meet tough times, but thank you so much that every tough time we are ever going to meet, you will be right there with us, Lord. And that's where real peace is found. It's in your name we pray. Amen.